The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
I'd like to begin tonight by asking you a little bit of what you know about the Puritan style of love and marriage. Maybe we ought to take a step further back. Maybe some of you do know something about that. What is the popular image of Puritanism in such an area? How would the man in the street, if he had heard of Puritanism, and most people have had some vague notion that there were such things at one time or another, you know, how would they see the Puritan? What would they see him if they knew anything at all? The senator from Arkansas a few years back said some things. You know the one I mean. Fulbright. Brilliant man, you know, in his own way. Had some things to say about American Puritanism and its residual damage. So if that gives you any clue, how would they view a Puritan view of love or marriage? Anyone willing to break the ice? Yes. That pretty well puts it together, that most people, when they think of Puritanism, they hear the word, they really think Victorianism. And they think of that which is cold and stoical, and you might add the word repressed, right? I think that's pretty good. It gives you, I think, the heart of the picture. Now, anything anyone else would like to add to that, that strikes you as part of that picture? All right. Even in the Puritans' own day, there was some that laid that charge at their door. The statement was made by one contemporary who was non-Puritan that they multiply like rabbits. So that was very definitely. And, of course, that is really more or less a medieval view of marriage. It exists for the sake primarily of procreation, or maybe exclusively for that purpose. All right. Yes. Anyone else that occurs to you? Anything? Well, I think that's really true, that the popular image of the Puritan in love would be that he would be very guarded in any use of language that might be frank or open, and that woman would exist in some kind of state of repression under a Puritan regime, and that the Puritan ideal would be one of asceticism, and the word might well be self-control. A key word. Now, I'm going to make one observation that there's just a little bit of truth in this at one point, that there was a strong emphasis in English Puritanism I don't think they used the word self-control, but the word they liked was sober. Now, I'm going to raise the question whether that sober. I'm going to raise the question whether that really was Puritan, but it certainly was among them. And exactly what they meant by that word, we'll talk about later. So I just want to raise a little question in your mind, how we're going to follow that one out and see if there is something there. All right, now, let's have some quotations. I'd like to read a few from American Puritans. And, they're American Puritans. They all started out in England, so you could call them English Puritans if you wanted. But we got a particular breed of them over here. And so we'll start with that, mostly the breed that came across the Atlantic. Now, here is a quote from a letter from a lady named Margaret. She was writing to a a man named John Winthrop, to be exact. And she says this. This is clear back in England before they had made that well-known trip across the Atlantic. She says this: "I will not look for any long letters this term because I pity your poor hand. If I had it here, I would make more of it than ever I did and bind it up very softly for fear of hurting it." That was a Puritan woman writing. And it's quite interesting, isn't it? Very interesting way. Now, John Winthrop, this is a quote from another one of his letters, how he felt about Margaret. "My sweet spouse, let us delight in the love of each other as the chief of all earthly comforts." So, you don't find really a Victorian spirit in that, which eventually came to the place where they couldn't call an arm or a leg, they were limbs, you know, and so the that certainly isn't there. Now here's, you remember Edward Taylor, the one who called Christ heaven's sugar cake, if you recall back that early in the course. he kept comparing Christ, these very striking metaphors from food and so on. Well, you'd expect him to say something kind of interesting about his wife, too, and so you're not all that disappointed. Here's a letter to the young woman who later became his wife. It was his sweetheart at this stage. "My dove, I send you, not my heart. For that, I trust, is sent to heaven long since, and unless it has woefully deceived me, it has not taken up its lodging in anyone's bosom on this side of the royal city of the great king. But yet most of it that is allowed to be laid out upon any creature does safely and singly fall to your share." And then in the same letter, he's warming up now, you know. And he speaks of his love to her as a golden ball of pure fire. That's Edward Taylor taking off, building up a poetic momentum and so on. Now, am I carrying away books tonight? I forgot a couple. But anyway, if you read in Anne Bradstreet's poetry, you'll find he was governor, and her poems to him are very much frank and open, and even describe the physical relationships with one another. And then Thomas Hooker, who certainly was one of the soberer ones among the Puritans, he was the, if you remember earlier, I don't expect you to remember everything I said in this course. If you drop a word here or there, I don't mind. But I had said about the conflict between Cotton, remember, with his strong emphasis on grace and others. Peter Bulkley was kind of the other team, and John Winthrop was, I didn't mention that so much, was kind of on the other team. And Hooker really kind of leaned over that way, too. But now, Hooker, here is something that Hooker said, and here is his picture of a husband. "The man whose heart is endeared to the woman he loves, he dreams of her in the night, hath her in his eye, and apprehension when he awakes, museth on her as he sits at table, walks with her when he travels, and parleys with her in each place where he comes." This is all in imagination. "That the husband tenders his spouse with an endeared affection above all mortal creatures, this appears by the expressions of his respect, that all he hath is at her command, all he can do is wholly improved for her content and comfort, she lies in his bosom, and his heart trusts in her, which forceth all to confess that the stream of his affection, like a mighty current, runs with full tide and strength." Now, Hooker, in this particular instance, wasn't even talking about marriage. He was rather using this as an illustration to tell you how you ought to feel about Christ. But he's assuming, this is the way a normal man thinks about his wife, or the one he's going to marry. And I think it's interesting just because it is so incidental that he's using it by way of illustration. The kind of thing that everybody can take for granted, that's the way you should be. So that kind of commitment is really striking, isn't it? How it jars with the ordinary view of the Puritan view of love. Now, a number of these quotations I have taken from the book The Puritan Family by Edmund S. Morgan. Now, you should have read that one for tonight. It's on reserve. And this is the section, Puritan Love and Marriage. I duplicated it for myself. Now, I'd also commend to you, if you want to dig just a good deal deeper into this, this is Levin Schucking. Now, Schucking is a German. And since he's a German, he's prejudiced against English. That's why it makes his evaluation so interesting. Because it's well worth, if you want to understand Western culture, I wouldn't miss this book. And I wouldn't miss the book by Edmund S. Morgan, The Puritan Family. They both have the same big title. This book, however, has a different subtitle. It's a literary study, a social study from the literary sources. This one deals with English Puritans, pretty much. And the other book, the one from whom I took this material, deals with American Puritans. Basically, same general, you know, it's a genus, but some differences here in the species a bit. Now, so if you want to do further work beyond that, I would commend to you kind of an amazing book in its own way, C.S. Lewis's The Allegory of Love. That's well worth reading. Some scholars have challenged it in the modern world, but when I did my Ph.D. work, it was ranked in literary studies as one of the, what was it, one of the best, 30 best works in the last, I don't know, can't remember now, but at least it was highly touted book, well, very well received. So Lewis is a scholar in his own right. He's an able scholar. Now, sometimes he got in a field where he probably wasn't all that able, but when he was in his own field, he really knew what he was doing. So you might want to get that book, too. This is a very important area. Well, we could go ahead and read more about Puritanism as in that way, but I'd like to give you now a little bit of an overview of something of another side to Western culture, a way of viewing it. And you can really write culture from the angle of how family, how marriage is viewed. And since we're kind of like the fish who swims in the sea, we may not notice temperature changes. And, you know, the ice may form across the top and, you know, great storms blow and we don't realize all that's going on. And what you may not realize is that we are going through a great love revolution at this point. The 20th century is undergoing a love revolution. It's carrying on one that was initiated in the 18th and 19th centuries, and it's come to a bitter harvest in our time. And if you want to read something about that, the way that is coming out, here is a... I'm going to put these two on reserve. I'll let one of you take them over, and maybe we can get them stamped together. But anyway, the first is The Revolt Against Love by Robert Hendon. Ron Lutz introduced me to this one. And it's very important. You ought to know that. If you're going to be a pastor, do any counseling, you ought to know what's going on in this article. It's Harper's, August 1975. You may want to duplicate your own copy of it. Then something that will really put things in focus for you, though neither of these are from a Christian point of view, The Family Out of Favor by Michael Novak. And that is Harper's, April 1976. very perceptive article. Michael Novak is a Roman Catholic intellectual, and he is quite knowledgeable in theology, though this has no touch, not a direct touch with theology. And basically what they've come down to is that today is an age of rejection of the family and the whole idea of even having children. The family out of favor begins. Well, let me just read it. Recently, a friend of mine told me the following anecdote. At lunch in a restaurant, he had mentioned that he and his wife intended to have a second child soon. His listener registered the words, stood, and reached out his hand with unmistakable fervor. You are making a political statement. Congratulations. Now, we might say you are making a theological statement, but the point is that he tells him that he's being daring, having a second child. And you'd be surprised how rabid can be the attacks on people having children today. This is not that far off. And, of course, the other thing, the revolt against love, the point he makes in that article, is the seething hatred between the sexes on campus. That he says it takes any number of forms, but there's real rage, and he says especially male rage. And you can read it and see how he develops his ideas. Now, so let's use this kind of, let's get a view of love through the ages. And by and large, what we think of as Christian love and the idea of the Christian family is unknown in the whole world. The idea of an agape love is revolutionary. It's even revolutionary in some nominally Christian countries. And we may have some time to talk about that, how the theology of Rome has influenced the family. Now, if you can remind me to come back to that at some point, we'll do that. But we can't cover everything in one night, and so we may not get that deep into the theology of Rome. But so what I want to get you to see is when the gospel came into the world, you can't realize how revolutionary it was. It was an age in which certain things, such as abortion, was practiced. Also, child exposure was very common, very common. And the whole idea of slavery as a cruel institution was there. But the idea of somebody really loving somebody else and giving his life was pretty strange stuff. And the idea of the kind of redeemer that the Bible said Jesus happened to be, that sounded strange. You see, and the reason they said, those who've turned the world upside down have come here also. They were not trying to say something commendatory. They were trying to say those screwballs are here loose again. The atheists have arrived. They talk about a God you can't see, and that's atheism. We're theists, polytheists, but theists. And you can see our God, so you know we're believers, but these are the atheists. And they do all kinds of crazy things, and they're cannibals, too. Did you hear that? They talk about love, but they talk about this body, you eat it. Well, this was all through right through the world. They thought these Christians were nutty nuts. And then the idea of a man showing tenderness to his wife, well, occasionally, you might, but who wants to get carried into that kind of thing, You can lose your manhood if you're not careful. And therefore, if you may want to respect her, if she comes from a noble family like yours because she's got relatives. And you have to keep one eye on the relatives, but other than that, you wouldn't want to beat her more than necessary, but that would be sort of where it was. So it was a world which much, much different from any we've ever known, a world without hospitals, all the things that have come with Christian culture. That was the world, the ancient world. And essentially, it was a world that knew much about the cruelty of man to man, the cruelty of man to woman. And submission was something that a woman, how could she do it, she might think. Men are cruel, they're male chauvinists. Sounds a little familiar, but... And you see, a woman who might want to get liberated in that ancient world, and believe me, there were plenty of women as the culture began to decay who wanted to get liberated, and eventually they kind of took over. As the thing finally collapsed before the gospel came, became more triumphant, the women did take over in many areas of life. And the idea of becoming quite rebellious. And so, on the one hand, you had the gospel presenting man as a tender person, compassionate, as well as just, and you had woman presented as submissive. Well, the ancient world didn't want much of either. And the battle between the sexes, you see, is a pretty eternal one from the point of view of human history, at least perennial, not eternal. Now, in that, with that background then, you had someone like Ovid, the poet, making fun of love. He's making a lot of jokes about love, and he speaks of these love gods. Well, it's in his writing about love, this Roman poet, he mocks it. And you know, even our picture of Cupid, the arrow hits you and you begin to act and do crazy things that are amusing, you see, to the general world, but you are slightly insane or more so. Well, that goes back to Ovid and that spirit. So it was really a mockery. And it was a world really of essentialism rather than love. Now, when the Middle Ages came on, the gospel penetrated a ways, but there was this tremendous counter-reaction from the influence of Greek and Roman thought in the direction of asceticism. And so a common statement was, in the Middle Ages, that the passionate love of one's wife is adultery. Now that's what most people think Puritanism is. But that was, I think that's almost a direct quote. I think it is word for word quote from one of the medieval fathers. The passionate love of one's wife is adultery. And so that means that self-control with a vengeance. So in that, you have the whole setup then, the medieval period, was that there had come a certain new dignity to marriage. The gospel had penetrated in some measure the culture, but there was that powerful rooting in the ascetic and the sensual tradition, and so there was a fear of marriage. And in the medieval period, you got a sort of a view of holiness somewhat like this, that here is the physical world, and that equals the least holy. Now, this is right out of Greek thought. You know, this is Gnosticism in some of its forms. This is Platonism, so on. The least holy is the physical, because it's down where you get the, to quote Plato, the blood. What is it? Blood, hair, filth of this world. And therefore, this is the least real and the least holy. That means, in the structure of the medieval church and its life, its culture, that the man who is unmarried, the woman who is unmarried, is not in contact with physical so much, therefore you're moving one step away, you're up, if you don't get married, if you remain a virgin. Then, if you not remain a virgin, but you become a member of the clergy, the secular clergy, that was another step up, you were more holy still. Now, the secular clergy were the clergy in contact with people. That's why they were called secular. So they're moving up. Now, regular clergy, those are the real guys, they were more holy yet because they had no contact with the world. And so holiness then was withdrawal from ordinary business, Holiness was withdrawal from things like marriage because that there's something unclean in this relationship. And of course, this is Greek thinking touching and influencing the Christian faith. And it's only later that there begins to be a break made with this. Well, also, and through the medieval period, as the gospel faded into the background more and more, the view of Christ became, at first he was the shepherd. If you look at medieval early architecture, Christ is portrayed as the shepherd. He's the strong shepherd, which would not necessarily be apart from love. But as you go on through the medieval period, to the high, the late part, Christ is the judge. You see, that's how you meet him in the Apostles' Creed. I'm never wholly comfortable with the Apostles' Creed. You know, I wish Luther had rewritten it, or Calvin. Of course, Calvin did in writing his comments. But nonetheless, you'll notice the emphasis there. There's only one line on the forgiveness of sins, and then the Lord is coming as judge. Well, now he is judge, and I'm not denying that, except I like a little more about mercy. And I don't know how you feel about that. But well, now, so we could talk about this a good deal, but if you want to catch something of this from a painting, now it's not in the area simply of the sexual marriage, but if you go down to the Philadelphia Art Museum and you go up the medieval section, there's a painting there by Jan van Eyck. I'm not sure of Dutch. Is that Eyck? Have any of you seen it? Oh, you've got to see it. The painting gives you St. Francis in the front receiving the stigmata, which maybe really did happen, the marks of the cross on his hands, and in the background, if you look very closely, and they've got a blown-up version of it there, I think, which they have expanded it, you see is the real world of people. That is, the religious world is in the foreground, the holy, and the background is the physical action where people live, the city of this world. And so there's a dichotomy there. And you look at that painting, I guess it's just called St. Francis Receiving the Stigmata. It's a very small painting. And as you come down the corridor, as you come into the medieval section, it's on your left. But you can find out without any trouble where it is. Now, what this reveals is that even in the medieval period, there was some kind of suffocation going on in the area of love, and people were reaching out. And what happened with St. Francis, and what Van Eyck caught, at least, is a little bit, is that there was a rebirth of awareness of God's love in Francis of Assisi. Francis of Assisi, believe it or not, you know, we Protestants get turned off by him because he went around talking to the birds and so on. Really, I think he's much more on our team than that might make you think. Because he was seeing something in nature that, you see, it's holy, and this is radically different. Then I didn't really quite understand St. Francis, because he was seeing the whole world as belonging to God. Now, there may have been an ascetic element in St. Francis. I think there was. But he's one of the saints, at least. I feel kind of comfortable with saying that maybe he was a saint, you know, a believer. Now, when you apply this to him, what was central in his theology? Well, you can detect this if you take a trip through Europe or any book on the history of architecture and paintings and so on. You'll find that when St. Francis comes along, that the statues of Christ change. Now, I'm basically in the Scots tradition, so I'm not just, you know, red hot about images of Christ, as you could guess. But nonetheless, I think if you look at them, you find that at this point, you get the suffering Christ. You get a rebirth of awareness of atonement, the love of God. And this is really what's driving St. Francis. He's much more in the Augustinian tradition than anyone else. Well, anyone else. He certainly is someone who's much more driven by the love and the grace of God than others. And so the Franciscans are influenced by that from the beginning. And this is what, in the 12th century, makes them that great missionary order. And it's, you know, St. Francis, he loves Jesus, and he hears they're having a little problem over in the Eastern Mediterranean. Some people call it a crusade or two, and so he said, well, he doesn't think that's quite the way to do it. He said, why don't I go and talk to the Sultan about Christ? So here comes this figure marching across the sands, and it's no other than Francis of Assisi. What are you here for? Well, I'm here to talk to you about Jesus. And they were so startled, they welcomed him in, and he got to talk to the Sultan. Now, the Sultan didn't become a Christian, apparently, but at least they were so taken by surprise that it was a different kind of witness than they had been seeing from the Crusaders, who had gone to a different school of theology. They had taken the wrong side of Augustine, and that's literally true. What I'm saying is true. They had taken the wrong side of Augustine, because out of the Donatist controversy, Augustine had finally given in to the principle and even adopted it that you might take a man's life in order to save his soul. And the Crusaders were doing that with a great deal of enthusiasm, but I don't think there was much guarantee that any souls were getting saved. Now, at the same time, around the 12th century, not only in Italy, but in France, in the area of Provence, there was a rebirth of an awareness of love, which was equally revolutionary, maybe even more revolutionary, because what was Francis had to give was implicit in a lot of Christian teaching, and there must have been a lot of people in the church who still knew a lot about the love of Jesus. But here came on something that was radical. And what they did essentially, these people, they were called troubadours. You know, you've heard of this kind of thing, right? Here came a big romantic love revolution. They took all that was in Ovid, which he had written down as a sensual joke, and they made it into their religion. And you had, coming here, a rebirth of love. Now, there was also coming with within the church, a rebirth. That's not the word I want. There was a development of Mariolatry, worship of the Virgin. And you had to get. You tend to get two splits in it. On the one hand, you had the elevation of the Virgin, and on the other hand, over against that, you had the elevation of secular woman, the beautiful woman. And if you want to get a good rundown of how this was viewed and this courtly love, simply take Chaucer's Troilus and Cressida and read it. It's all in there. And the basic thing I want you to remember about it was this. It was a love ritual in which your goddess was love, and it had to be an illegitimate relationship. And so for a long, long time across Western Europe, under the influence of that tradition, love was always something for someone who is not your wife. Now that was reinforced by a lot of social factors, that in the Middle Ages, marriage was a means for the upper classes at least, of maintaining the family, right? Your heritage, your inheritance, your property, strengthening your position in society. That marriage was a matter of feudal relationships of lordship, suzerainty, and the rest. And so now what I want you to see is that this radical revolution came in because that social setting was dry. It was terribly dry. And so when St. Francis represented a movement which was different, a rebirth of the love of God, but right along with it, you had this this courtly love, really kind of a religion of love, in which woman was turned into a goddess. And the characteristic mark of the Middle Ages was swinging back and forth from one form of these loves to another. You know, a man might for a time idolize a mistress. He would write her love poetry, love letters, so on, and with the intention of seducing her, or they wouldn't put it quite that crudely, but that's what it came down to. And you have a lot of things explained in the Middle Ages by that. And then the feeling guilty, and then the swinging back to the worship of the Virgin at the other end. So given that kind of a swing, the tendency in the Middle Ages is to, to mix kind of the blood and the roses. It's a time of great extremes in which there's Christianity, but it's so unbalanced. The society is very, very much in these terms of great swings. And towards the end of the Middle Ages, society was dying because the power in these ideas came to bitter fruition. The society was sick. Have you ever read Poe's The Dance of Red Death? Isn't it the title of it? He's talking about real events. At the end of the Middle Ages, they were so sick that they would have balls in which everyone would come masquerade, wearing the masquerade of death. And they would play the various roles in the ball, which is a sick thing to do. And the world really was morally, spiritually sick. Now, let me just draw from this a couple of implications that, and I'm going to anticipate something of the answer I'm going to give. If you study world's religions, that you'll tend to find in it a soft side and a strong side, a feminine principle and a masculine principle. Have you ever noticed that in world's religions? Now, you take primitive religions, what's the feminine principle? The earth, and the goddesses of the earth. And, of course, this runs right into the Virgin Mary, because the worship of the Virgin Mary is simply a continuation of this, right out of the great mother cult of Asia Minor. And so but it reflects a deep need in the person, which is to be understood. These religions aren't without reason. There's something deep within the man, or in woman, which requires satisfaction. So when the man makes an idol, he's trying to satisfy himself in some way. So the soft, or the feminine, is there in religions, the need for the tender. And the other side, there is the strong, the high gods, the sky gods, those who have power. And you have the same thing in Chinese thought. So what is it? Yin and yang? The whole idea is of that kind. So I would say you find that very, very much. And, you know, there's even a tender moment in Immanuel Kant. I say that with a twinkle because I used to be a great fan of Immanuel Kant. I was first became a Christian. I met the OP pastor, you know, and he was talking about these people who carry Immanuel Kant around like it was the Bible, you know. I didn't have a copy with me at the time, but I was one of those people. And knowing a little bit about Kant, there's even a tender spot occasionally flashing through that intellectual machine. And you find it in places in the Critique of Practical Reason, Critique of Judgment. But what I'm saying is that these needs are in every human heart. That doesn't mean that these needs are properly met. They usually instinctively are handled in an idolatrous way. But the need is there, and everybody has them. All except the English. Now, that's where the trick comes in. Because of all of the people in the Middle Ages, the English didn't get into this act very easily. And it may be there was just more sincere Christianity in England. I don't know. The English might attribute it to racial superiority or the purity of the air or something. I don't know. But you find comparatively less of this in England. And you find a pretty strong Augustinian grace tradition there. And you don't find a lot of dirty literature in medieval English. I know, I had to read almost all of it for my PhD in various dialects, and I was pretty filled up with it, and I was amazed. You compare that with French literature, they had to translate the French literature into the English to get this over into England. Now, it was in England, the Romance of the Rose, which Chaucer translated, was a filthy, you know, it was French pornography. But it didn't originate in English soil, and Chaucer himself began to create something which really is not deep in English literature, that which is unclean, filthy. It's comparatively clean literature in its tradition. Now, having said that, what was going on really by the time the Reformation had come around? Well, here's the situation you have. At least as far as literature is concerned, I know of no instance where a man ever wrote a love letter to his wife. Now, they must have. I mean, I obviously you can't. There must have been somebody in that. Now, and it may be my ignorance that there may be love letters around that I just missed. I'm thinking about English literature. But, again, I didn't go through that with too thick. You know, the comb teeth were pretty thin when I got through there. I had to look at it pretty closely. The other thing I've noticed is that English literature, I don't know of a love poem a man wrote to his wife until the 16th century, after the Reformation was going full blast. Now, that's mind-boggling. Now, again, people may have written at least doggerel to their wives. I would think they did. But it was so much not done that when Edmund Spenser did it and wrote a sonnet series called Amoretti, it was shocking. A love revolution had broken into the world. A man has written a sonnet series to his wife. What a brazen thing to do. Can you see the irony of that? Now you can go through all, you see, most people read Western culture as just flat, the history of it. They don't realize these great sweeps up and down. And most of the historians who write about it tend to, you know, they're always talking about the rising middle class. You know, I often wonder about historians when the middle class was ever going to get risen. But, you know, this was... The many things that are really obvious, if you read more closely, are missed. And I would suspect that many of you didn't have a clue to what I was going to say tonight. And you hadn't appreciated what a revolutionary thing was put into your hands when you were given a Bible. Because it was the Bible that led men to write love letters to their wives. Until they had the written word translated, nobody ever thought about it. But you see, they couldn't prevent it once they began to read Ephesians 5. See? And interestingly enough, when he writes his love sonnet series to his wife, what do you know? Most glorious Lord of life. He starts off with one of the sonnets, and I memorized it some years back, so I can't go too much further down, but it's essentially a praise of Christ for the resurrection done along the lines of Ephesians 5. It's his marriage day.
And so I guess instead of sitting there twiddling his thumbs while he was getting ready to get married on that particular Sabbath day, this Puritan, Edmund Spenser, wrote this particular sonnet. And it's a resurrection sonnet about marriage. And he had very good reason for wanting to get married on the Sabbath day, because he believed that was most appropriate, you see, when the time of the new life came. And from this point on, you begin to have the thing that you meet in Puritanism. Now, what I want you to see, and some of this is what shucking brings out. Now, some of shucking's language is really interesting. He calls this Puritan revolution, this Protestant revolution, a respect for womanhood, which in this particular form is wholly without precedent. And what he's talking about, not only the fact that the Puritans were celebrating the sexual relationship and the union of it, but they were also bringing to their writings and what they believed about marriage an unprecedented tenderness. See, the others had been writing about love. Usually it wasn't their wives. But you see, when that gallant out of this tradition wrote about the woman, he put her up here in the pedestal. But once he possessed her, he might brutalize her. Man's cruel. Women are too. But a man, you see, has the power. In that world, he had the power, usually. And it's frightening to think of how women really were used and abused before the Reformation. So he says that. And then here's another comment from Shocking. This is from page 47 in that book. He speaks of an astonishingly advanced conception of love. And basically what they were working with was Ephesians 5. And we all know that Ephesians 5 is that grand passage in Scripture in which Christ compares the man and the woman with Christ and the church. And Paul gets so caught up in his imagery that he maybe doesn't forget himself which he's referring to. But then he has to stop so you don't forget to which he's referring to. And so he has to say, now, I'm referring about Christ and the church, you know, at this point. He's got to explain. And you see, he has such a high view of Christian marriage that he even has to stop and say that holy, sacred relationship between Christ and the church is so close to it, I have to stop for a minute and tell you which is which. And it was out of that tenderness in which the husband was to love his wife right to giving his own life for her, and the wife joyfully delighting in submitting herself to his leadership, it's this that was the spark, you see, that set fire to a lot of cultural debris and brought in a God's blessing on New England. And I want to make a conclusion of right here at this point. I'm persuaded that one reason God blessed New England with so few deaths in the family. See, this is why they multiplied so rapidly. It was not that they had more children than the French. That charge was not true, that they simply multiplied like rabbits, but rather they had less disease. And I think one reason was there was a new obedience to God in these basic areas of life, and the hand of God blessed these families, and therefore they multiplied. Now, I don't want to make, you know, a one-to-one correlation between obedience and blessing of an outward kind, because God might withhold children from some families. And they'd still be under his blessing. But nonetheless, I think you see a great blessing there in that situation. Well, we haven't gone in detail into the Puritan view of marriage, what was involved in it. What do we have for time? We have a few minutes. I can get some more in here. Now, let me see. Well, let me make it even stronger. That Shakespeare's view of marriage, of man and woman, is fairly high. But this kind of tenderness, which came into Puritanism, is really above Shakespeare. That's unknown to Shakespeare. And I think that's quite remarkable that God would use this kind of the truth to have that kind of salting effect on marriage. And so life would immediately become not only more bearable for people, but actually enjoyable, you know? And not just for one member of the family, but for both. And of course, any man would find that if he made life very miserable for his wife, she would have ways of making life miserable for him. And it just works that way. I mean, as Paul warned in Ephesians 5, that you want to treat your own body well, treat your wife well, because she belongs to you. So I think that's very, very important to see. Now you can add other things in it, the whole matter of faith, the priesthood of believers, the fact that the wife as well as the husband was a believer and near to God, that spiritually they were equals. All of this entered into the picture. And so we could go on, but I think that's really kind of giving you some sort of explanation of why the Puritans in New England and England were doing these strange things culturally. You with me pretty much on this? See what's going on. Now, to apply that today, what you see is the dying out of the influence of that tradition and the replacing of it by a romantic tradition which has gone bankrupt. That's essentially what you have now. And where we are now, we're very much in a parallel situation to the end of the Middle Ages. Not in every respect, because we still have a lot of salt around in terms of gospel teaching. But in terms of the culture as a whole, we're back to the pornography, the lust, the uncontrollable appetite, the worship of woman as a sex symbol, all the rest. It's all here. And it comes with terrible power. It's devilish. And you can see now just how theology gets right down into life. Let me make, rather than listing some other things about Puritan ideas on love, let me just make a contrast here with Roman Catholic Spain. And it'll help you to understand the benefits of living in a Protestant country. When we were there in the summer of 1970, we had a number of shocks. There were some very fine things in Spanish culture that we learned to appreciate. And I won't list all of those. They're really an admirable people. But one thing you was interesting to me, we were talking to sort of our host, and we were saying, well, Spain looks very good to us. Maybe it's better than the U.S. He says, well, I don't know about that. He said when he was here in this country, he worked for a time for the Christian Reformed Church in a city in Michigan. He worked among the Mexican migrant workers, and they were always buying cars and not buying licenses to go along with them. At that time, they had first, I guess, come into the country, and they didn't realize all of them. They didn't speak English or something, and they would get a car and drive off without a license. And so working with them, he was often down at the police station. And so this particular, I guess it was the first time he went down there, he went into the police station, and the officer with whom he's going to speak told him, well, came out, there's a little delay, and he asked him, started talking about it a little bit. He said, well, we had a prayer meeting in here. He said, you know, it's a very difficult thing to be just, and we really want to be just, and so we've been praying about it. He said he about fell over, you know. He says, that's impossible. In my country, he says, I never heard of anything like that. He says, it may be dying out in your country, but he says, the very fact it's dying out and maybe doesn't exist that much anymore, the very fact it once existed is still an interesting thing. And he says, not having had that tradition, we're much more exposed to the arbitrary and the cruel. And he says, you don't realize what a benefit it is to a nation to have had the gospel preached in it. So that was very striking. Now the other thing is, my wife is blonde, and that's a problem in Spain. And if you're planning to go single girl to Spain, even whether you're blonde or not, don't. Don't go by yourself. I wouldn't commend that, even southern France. You should be careful. So anyway, my wife came running into our apartment one day, just out of breath and scared to death. And this man had followed her and been terribly persistent. And so my natural reaction was to run out there and find him, but I didn't see where I was going to find him because he'd be long gone. Anyway, we got talking to a neighbor about it later, and we said, well, my wife said, well, what do I do in a situation like that? My husband's not there. And then she said, should I call a policeman? And the neighbor said, oh, that wouldn't do any good. And so our American eyes popped wide open, and we said, why not? His reply was, why, he'll just say, a man's a man. And what do you expect? And he turned to her and he says, the only way for you to get rid of him is to be as mean as this. And then he gave her some well-chosen phrases to say to the man, of a very vicious sort, in order to get rid of him. Well, you know. But as we talked this over with him, what it turned out was, even though he was a modern Spaniard, did not go to church any longer, was pretty much an agnostic, he had deeply written into him that Roman Catholic theology, that the body is sort of out of control because it's part of the physical world, the unholy, and you can never quite tell how to get control of it unless you really treat it in an ascetic way to get control. And so the whole idea of Roman Catholic salvation has been touched with Greek thought, and that here in the, I don't want to oversimplify this, and I will just a little bit, their idea here is in the divine image, there's a sort of a donum super additum. You get that still in theology here, don't you? Okay. I didn't know what you, I didn't want to show I was. Anyway, you have this divine gift, which is sort of like a hat on man. That's original righteousness of this gift. And in the fall, the hat gets knocked off. And you had an order here. At the top, you had, the reason, the rational faculty, and then you had, or spirit, I guess they might put in here, spirit and reason. And then underneath it, you have the body. And the body has a natural tension with reason or mind or spirit, and so the body rebels when this hat goes off and the body takes over. And that's essentially Hindu also. That's a Hindu idea of what the fall is, if they have an idea of the fall. So the idea is the body is in revolt. And so what he was really saying is this man can't help it. It's his body. And believe it or not, they can't help it. Because they believe they can't help it. Now, it's really, and they have no way then, you see. The forgiveness of sins then becomes simply the confession of individual sins of the body. And there's never a dealing with what is the real seat of sin, which is what? The heart. Not the physical heart, but the soul, the center of man. And the body is simply an instrument which he uses, and it gets a power over him. Surely that's true. But when you get that heart changed and cleansed, and the body begins to change in your use of it. There may be defeats and discouragements, but the Holy Spirit lives in the man to help him.